This is the Airplane Geeks Podcast. Our aim is to educate and inform you, explore and expand your passion for aviation, and entertain you a little along the way. This episode, we look at airline seats with smart textiles that you control with an app. Boeing Embraer ventures for commercial jets in the KC-390, business jet deliveries in 2018, re-engining the B-52 fleet, regional jets and scope clauses, a lithium-ion battery ban on commercial flights, the fifth anniversary of the loss of MH-360 and an interesting theory, rumors of covert F-117 missions in the Middle East, and an airline pilot who flew for 20 years with a fake license. We also have an airplane of the week, the Nakajima B-5N Type 97 bomber, and two videos that you'll want to see, an aerobatic demonstration routine flown by the U.S. Air Force F-35A Lightning II demonstration team, and an Air Force recruitment video associated with the new Captain Marvel movie. All that and more coming up right now. Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 542 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and joining me first is David Vanderhoof, our Airplane Geeks historian. Hey, David.
Hey, Max. Hello, everyone. Looking forward to a good show. Lots of things to talk about tonight.
We do have quite the lineup here, don't we? Also joining us, of course, is Max Trescott, host of Aviation News Talk podcast, the 2008 CFI of the Year, and an expert on the Cirrus aircraft. Hey, Max.
Max. Yeah, that sounded good. Just keep talking. I enjoy hearing about that.
No,
I'm kidding. I'm kidding. How the heck are you?
I'm good. Now, this episode, we don't have a guest, and that was the plan. I was scheduled for jury duty today, and with these things, you never know. It can range anywhere from canceled to surprise. You're on a 2-week trial, and you never know until that day. So the way it worked out, it was canceled, but we intentionally didn't schedule a guest. Instead, we have, a couple of things, but including a lot of news stories of various sorts that are pretty interesting that we can talk about. So let's get started with the news. Is everyone ready?
Ready from the West.
Ready.
Our first story comes from CNN. This is Airbus Economy Seat Prototype. Are these the future of airline cabins? We talked about seats a bit last episode. This is concerning a company called Layer Design. They're based in London. They call themselves a strategic design agency. Their website is layerdesign.com. And the company's made up of a group of industrial and digital designers and engineers, artists, experience experts. That's kind of an interesting job title. Researchers and branding specialists. And they've developed a prototype airline seat for Airbus. And it's called the Move, M-O-V-E. It's intended to improve the experience of economy class for both short and mid-haul flying. Now, this is a pretty high-tech sounding seat. Here's the description. It's got a digitally knitted seat cover. I'm not even sure what that is exactly. It uses a smart textile, and it's got sensors that enable passengers to monitor and control various factors, things like seat tension, temperature, pressure, and movement. And you do all that using the Move app, which is also designed by Layer. Now, throughout the journey, Layer says Move analyzes data, automatically adjusts to the passenger to maintain optimal ergonomic comfort. And it can be configured by both the airline and the passenger to fit a wide variety of needs. So I've got to tell you guys, this sounds pretty high tech. Why don't I have one of these things in my car?
I'm sitting here looking at the picture, and I'm having the opposite reaction, looking at least from the front view. And I'm thinking, why don't they just call this the lawn chair furniture company? I mean, it looks like it's a fairly thin, you know, web design. Now, when you look at it from the rear, yeah, it looks like maybe there's a little bit more thickness to it. But, you know, it looks to me like the goal here may have been to figure out how do we pull, you know, every additional pound out of the weight of a seat. I mean, these things look like they're pretty light. I won't say flimsy, but they look awfully light and awfully thin. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I want to know how they handle impact. I mean,
like from the knees of the person behind you?
No, I was talking more of from a crash. I don't know. I agree with Max. They look kind of scary.
Well, here's the thing here. See, these seats don't even recline. And you talked about the thinness. Part of the idea here is the lightweight. And again, we talked about that impact last week. So they're designed to be very light. And in order to get the comfort that you would associate with a thicker, padded, kind of a traditional seat, it uses these sensors, and somehow the seat responds to you and to what you're after and the conditions, I guess. I don't know exactly, you know, how that works, but I think the idea is that despite the thinness and what they look like, they are comfortable. But I guess I'd have to sit in one and try it out first.
Well, at least we wouldn't have any wars about reclining seats. You know, that would be one aspect of flying that will now become a little more comfortable.
That's right.
I mean, well, the slimlines that I was on, the 717 in Hawaii, they didn't recline, but they actually were sort of comfortable. You know what? I'm done. We don't really need reclining anymore. I mean, unless we're on long haul, and then you should have a reclining seat, but I couldn't recline at all on my 321 coming home from LAX to PHL. So, you know, and that was a red eye. So, I mean, that's what I would want to recline in. Really, anymore, do these seats really recline even when they do recline? It's not like they're like going back to a complete layback position. It's not. So everybody just needs to buy neck pillows and suck it up.
Okay. All right, good. Let's move on. Next story. Boeing and Embraer venture gets shareholders' approval. This is a follow-up. This is from American Machinist. You know, we've talked about Boeing acquiring controlling interest, 80% of Embraer's commercial jet division. And the shareholders have voted. They've spoken. Two-thirds of the shareholders voted, according to American Machinist. And 96.8% of them approved the deal. So Embraer shareholders are viewing this joint venture as something that they really want to see. They've also, at the same time, voted on the KC-390. That would be a separate joint venture. Now, that's a little different equity position for Boeing. In fact, they would hold a minority position. Boeing would hold 49%, and Embraer would hold 51% of the KC-390 program. So that would give Embraer controlling interest for that. The KC-390, David, you know what that looks like to me? It looks like kind of like a mini C-17 with two engines instead of four.
Yeah, I mean, I like the KC-390. I think it's a really neat aircraft. Boeing wants a slice of Lockheed's pie. I mean, the 390 is just supposed to go up directly against the C-130J. So it's and it's capable of refueling, unlike the A400. So I mean, it's a cute little low cost cargo and refueler. I know that New Zealand's looking to buy them, as well as Brazil is already buying them. So interesting little jet, and interesting that Boeing wants a slice of that pie too.
I think it's got about half the capacity, roughly, of a C-17. And the KC-390 uses IAE engines, International Aero Engines, which was originally primarily partnered by Pratt & Whitney and Rolls-Royce a few years ago. Well, maybe more than a few now. Pratt bought Rolls-Royce share. So there are some other smaller partners in that, but that's basically a Pratt & Whitney operated enterprise. And of course, the C-17 also has Pratt & Whitney engines on the C-17. They're essentially the engines from a Boeing 757, a military version, but an awful lot of commonality between them. But all of this, of course, is still pending regulatory approval. But it sounds like Boeing and Embraer are anticipating that this will come together by the end of this year, 2019.
Now, there is one amusing aspect of this article from American Machinist, and it calls the KC-390 a medium airlift helicopter.
I saw that. I know.
Yeah. I hope the same machinists aren't working on any of these aircraft. I hope hope they're just behind the typewriter writing articles.
I know. When I read that, I thought, wait a minute. Is this a different kind of a KC-390? Because the one I know is not a helicopter. So, yeah, that's kind of an amusing goof in the article.
Yep.
Embraer has also talked in the past about stretching the KC-390. I think with the civil cargo market in mind, they've talked about adding a plug, one before the center section and one after. That would give it more capacity. But interestingly enough, that would also give it a side cargo door. So we'll see if with Boeing's involvement that comes to be. Next up, this is from the Robb Report. The Vision Jet was the most delivered business jet in 2018. Now, I don't know if you're familiar with the Robb Report. It's, well, at least the print magazine tends to have things that you can buy if you have more money than sense, maybe. It really is for the sort of the stratospheric audience. But in any event, they report that GAMA, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, says Cirrus delivered 63 SF-50 Vision jets last year in 2018. Big bump at the end of the year, though, Max, 22 in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, they were still ramping up. So it is kind of interesting that they sell more jets than any other jet company right now. But then again, it's a lower cost jet, and so it's more affordable than any other jet as well. Their first year, which was, 2017, they delivered 22. So they were still ramping up throughout all of 2018, delivered, 60. I think they'll probably be a little higher than that this year, somewhere between 60 and 80. They're doing about one a week right now, but I think that's still going to come up a little higher than that. It's still just an amazing airplane. There was one at Livermore over the weekend. They had a show on Friday. And I was flying into Livermore with a client. I could spot that thing from, 2 miles out, something like that, simply because the V-tail is so huge. I didn't know where on the ramp it was parked. It was parked, facing away from me, and I could see this massive V-tail. I would bet that every one of those rudder vaders is probably 8 to 10 feet long, something like that. I mean, it just, when you stand next to them, you're looking way up toward the top of those things. So yeah, it's still, I think, a gorgeous jet. And of course the technology in it is just fabulous. I just saw somebody who flies a Citation recently complained that they wish they had auto throttles in their more expensive Cessna Citation jet. So it's got a lot of nice features.
Well, at 63 Vision jets, Cirrus just barely squeaked, I guess, into the number one position for last year. The Challenger 350 from Bombardier was right behind at 60 jets. Next up was the Cessna Citation Latitude with 57. Then the Embraer Phenom 300E, that's a light jet, 53 deliveries. Honda delivered 37 in 2018, which was down from 43 in 2017. And they're actually tied with the Cessna Citation CJ3 Plus light jets. But they also note from Gamma that the overall business jet deliveries increased to 703 last year in 2018. In 2017, it was 677. So that's a 3.8% increase. It's also, I think they mentioned the second year in a row that the business jet deliveries have been up, which sounds great. Talk about around 700 a year. But when you look at the peak, which was in 2008, business jet deliveries were 1,317. So we're way, 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 way below that historic high.
And I think the industry is so cyclical that some of these peaks are unsustainable. You know, it's easy to look at and they go, oh, we're so much, you know, below that. But often those numbers, you know, tend to be bubbles a little bit in the final year before we get a, you know, a decline that occurs for one event or another. Of course, we had a large recession in starting the end of 2008. So that's what happened there. There was a statement out from Gamma, it's not in this article, that said it was the first year, and I want to say either 5 or 8 years, in which all segments in the market had grown year to year. Probably was 5 years. So when I say all segments, that included piston aircraft, turboprops, helicopters, jets. So overall, every segment did well, which is kind of unusual. Usually there'll be one that's up, that's one that's down. The other thing that caught my eye is that the piston segment, which did grow, and that's had a number of year-to-year declines in, you know, the last 8-10 years, the number one and number two best-selling piston aircraft are both Cirruses. The Cirrus SR-22T was the top-selling piston. The Cirrus SR-22, normally aspirated, was the second best-selling piston. And the third best-selling was the venerable Cessna 172. So Cirrus had the top two spots before it, you know, got to the third one, which was what used to be the most widely sold airplane in the world, the Cessna 172.
Hmm. Yeah, they certainly seem to be doing well. All right, next item. This is from IndyStar.com. Rolls-Royce Indianapolis to compete for a $1 billion U.S. Air Force contract and new jobs. Now, David, you can help us with this, but I think in 2017, the U.S. Air Force announced plans that they were going to replace the old, and I mean old, Pratt & Whitney TF-33 engines that currently power the B-52 bombers. And Rolls-Royce wants to bid on this. It looks like it's a 650-engine contract, or will be, to re-engine the fleet. And they want to look at their F-130 engines, which is it's a variant of the BR-725 commercial engine. It's what you find on the Bombardier Global Express, the Boeing 717, and the Gulfstream 5. David, it's... I think the Air Force has wanted to re-engine these B-52s for quite some time, haven't they?
I think they've wanted to re-engine the B-52s since the middle of the 80s. It's funny because it was supposed to, originally, the re-engining was supposed to happen simultaneously when we re-engined all of our KC-135s. The next thing to be re-engined at the time was the B-52, and that's when they've toyed with the idea, and it's been on and off, but, you know, eventually, you know, we were going to get at least 150 B-2s, which turned out to be 21, so that at the time they decided they weren't going to re-engine, and it comes up every so many years because we have 50-year-old aircraft still flying around that are not very fuel efficient, and there's a lot of life left in the fuselage and the wings, and the only thing really is the weakness for B-52 is its engine. So this is getting a little more concrete. I think since we're going to be flying these until the 2040s, at that point we'll be talking about 80-year-old airplanes, some 100-year-old. It'll be interesting to see what we can do. They're still technically part of our nuclear deterrent. Close to 100 B-1s have had that, due to arms considerations, been removed. So the nuclear deterrent, as far as aircraft goes, are B-52s and B-2s. And we know the B-52 is just an amazing aircraft. So it needs new engines. This is probably the most economical way, because I think the engines that they're going, the Rolls-Royce wants to put on the aircraft, can kind of fit in the cells that are already there. One of the issues that have been previously was converting the aircraft to maybe four engines instead of eight or something along those lines. But it looks like Rolls-Royce is trying to keep the engines at four or keep them at eight, but keeping the pylons due to weight and stuff the same, instead of making a big turbofan under hanging from the wings.
The Air Force hasn't issued the RFP yet formally, but I think what we're seeing here is Rolls-Royce sort of staking out their position, their intention to participate in this. GE has talked about what they might offer a little bit. They've mentioned the CF-34, which is a business jet engine primarily, a very well-established one. The military version of that, I think it's the same engine on the A-10, David. And besides the CF-34, GE talks about maybe the new Passport engine. That's what they have on the Bombardier Global 7000 and 8000. It's a newer engine developed from the LEAP engine. Everybody seems to think Pratt is probably also interested, but at least as reported here, they're not talking. So we don't know what Pratt & Whitney might have in mind for this.
It's a big deal. I mean, there's a lot of engines there, you know.
Yeah, over 600, 650 engines. Yeah, you're talking about a lot of business. Not only for the purchase of the engines, but for the lifetime of those engines, the spare parts and the maintenance and all that. But those TF-33s, oh gosh, I mean, those are essentially a military version of the 707 engine. And, so it's not surprising that when you see the videos of the B-52, you see all that smoke pouring out the back, because those were designed many, many, many years ago.
And the H was the only aircraft to carry those engines. We retired the Gs after Desert Storm in the early 1990s. So all we have left are the Hs with the turbofans and not the turbojets. So the H was the only aircraft to have that engine out of the series. So they're less smoky, but still pretty smoky.
All right. Interesting article from Forbes. This is United Airlines orders first-class regional jets, but they're not for you. Now, this is a story about scope clauses, under-configuring an airplane, and sending a message to the labor union, at least according to the writer, Samuel Engel. Max T., can you unpack this a little for us?
It is a fascinating move by United. In general, when you think about what airlines are doing to configurations of airplanes, it's how do you pack in, two more rows of seats? How do you get more people, into those airplanes? Lower that cost per seat mile. They're going out and buying new aircraft, and they're actually putting in fewer seats, and they're regional jets, which really is confounding. But it all makes sense when you start to understand the union-type agreements that they have and their relationships with the regional airlines. And it turns out that United has a so-called scope clause, which does not refer to their mouthwash, but actually refers to the size the size of the jets and the number of them that their contracts with the pilots and so on allow to be farmed out to the regional airliners or regional jet companies. And so they're allowed a maximum of 255 of the larger regional jets, which are rated between 70 and 76 seats. And they have some number of 50-seat RJs that they are allowed. But I think the 50-seat RJs have been out of production for a while, as I recall. Well, what they did is they're buying the Bombardier CRJ-550, which is a variant of the CRJ-700, and they're putting just 50 seats in it. And the reason they're doing that is they can now pass these jets off as being 50-seaters, even though they could hold 70 to or more seats in them. So it's a rather interesting maneuver. American Airlines did this back in the late 1990s and eventually got rid of the aircraft that they'd done that with simply because the cost per seat mile ended up being higher, which is probably what's going to happen here too. But it's a kind of an interesting end run around a contract to meet the letter of the law, but maybe not the spirit.
Yeah, the scope clauses, it's a strange concept to me. But, you know, what we have here is a small airplane with low density, and that's not normally a good business plan. But Engel says in this piece that Boeing is basically saying to the labor union that they're serious about scope clause restrictions, and they will even, quote, throw away money, which is basically what they're doing by going low density with these seats. But I guess the idea, regional pilots are paid less, and airlines would rather see more airplanes classified as regional, while mainline pilots get paid more, and so pilots would like to see more regional airplanes classified as larger jets. So you have this conflict here. And there's, I guess the contract agreement is coming up for renewal. And United may not be able to chip away at this scope clause concept this time, but I think they're trying to, you know, position themselves for a more serious run at it in the future. But again, scope clause, it's sort of a strange way to run a company.
What's really interesting, if you look at the regionals versus the majors, my understanding, and I haven't looked this up recently, is that more than half of all the departures in the U.S. now are flown by the regional airlines. You know, we think of the big four, but they're flying mostly longer routes and, you know, fewer flights. The regionals, boy, they've got those pilots just working like crazy. You know, they're up and down, up and down, up and down all day long. And, of course, they're just making a fraction of what the pilots make on the majors. So it's not a surprise that you know, United would like to push as many airplanes as they possibly can to be flown by the regionals.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think next week we have an airline pilot on as our guest, and so maybe we can poke at this a little bit more with him next week. But meantime, Isaac in our Slack team pointed us to an article about lithium batteries in cargo holds on passenger flights. And the U.S. Department of Transportation's Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, in coordination with the FAA, has issued an interim final rule that they say will enhance air safety by revising the hazardous material regulations for lithium-ion cells or batteries transported by aircraft. And this interim final rule prohibits the transport of lithium-ion cells or batteries as cargo on passenger aircraft. It also requires that lithium-ion cells and batteries to be shipped have no more than a 30% state of charge aboard cargo-only aircraft. So, you know, some interesting changes. So I'm not sure what the effects of all that will be, I guess, other than the fact that you won't have lithium ion batteries in cargo on passenger flights.
First of all, Max and I learned what an interim
final rule is.
Yeah, last week on the UAV Digest, causing all sorts of confusion. I actually experienced this because one of the major questions when we were flying from Hawaii back to LAX was, the suitcases that have the lithium built in for the carry-ons.
Yes.
They were asking people to remove them, you know, because we were on a booked flight and people were going to have to put their luggage in the cargo hold. Evidently that battery is removed from the luggage, is removable from the luggage. The other thing was I was thinking about as a direct relationship was, I normally pack my extra camera battery in my luggage. You know, I would have had to open up my luggage and take out my extra camera, my Nikon camera battery. And if you're carrying your drone, you need to carry your drone aboard your aircraft, or at least the battery you need to carry into the compartment.
Maybe. I mean, this says it's specifically lithium ion cells. Most of my drones and RC airplanes are using LiPo or lithium polymer cells. So it's kind of interesting that the covers, you know, one lithium style of battery, but not another very popular style. So I don't know if that's an oversight here, and you know, they really cover both. But that's kind of an interesting distinction right there.
Hmm. So, yeah, as David and I talked about on the UAV Digest, this concept of an interim final rule, we should probably mention that here as well. As I think many of you know, the FAA cannot just decree regulations. There's a process for creating new regulations. Typically, you have a notice of proposed rulemaking, an NPRM, where the FAA or the government invites comments for some period of time, then takes those or not, and develops the final rule. Well, there is a provision by which, under certain circumstances, the FAA can do that. In other words, issue an NPRM and solicit comments. But while that process is taking place, if there is a safety issue at hand, or there are some other reasons why it's not a good idea to wait for that process to unfold, they can release this interim final rule, and that's what's happened here. So the FAA has felt that this was a serious enough safety issue that they want to do this right away. So you still have the ability to submit comments. That of course happens at regulations.gov. We'll put the docket number in the show notes that'll help you find that on the web if you want to submit some comments. And then coming up on March 8th, 2019, is the fifth anniversary of the loss of MH370. Kind of hard to believe. You know. In the run-up to this anniversary, I've been seeing a lot of trash articles showing up with all kinds of clickbait headlines and sensational theories. But there is one that kind of caught my eye. And this comes from news.com.au. And there is a journalist, I take it a fairly well-respected journalist, Ian Higgins, who has written a book, The Hunt for MH370. And he explores a theory that portrays the flight crew as valiantly trying to deal with a cockpit fire. So here is the siren goes by outside.
Boy, that was timing. Cockpit fire and the.
Here comes the fire department. So, in a nutshell, and this is the condensed version a little bit, the theory is that the pilot side windshield heater caught fire and burned out the secondary radar transponder and the ACAR system. So the pilots do what they should do. They don their oxygen masks and they cut power to the left electrical AC bus. So that turns off the satellite data the unit that handshakes with Inmarsat. So that explains one thing. The pilot flies the plane, or one pilot flies the plane, and the other works on the fire with a fire extinguisher under this theory. Now, of course, we don't get any communications from them because, as we all know, the sequence is first you aviate, then you navigate, and thirdly you communicate. So no communications because they're a little bit busy. Now, the theory is that while reaching with the extinguisher, an oxygen mask tube is accidentally pulled out, and that feeds the fire uncontrollably because we know what oxygen does in the presence of a fire, or what oxygen does to a fire, rather. He theorizes that one pilot makes it out of the cockpit, probably badly burned, but the other dies in his seat. Now, the fire weakens the bottom of the windshield. It pops. You lose pressurization. Air rushes out of the cockpit. The temperature falls, and the fire goes out. But now you've got this aircraft decompression. The oxygen masks drop, which gives the passengers about 12 minutes of breathing time. But they're at altitude. They're not over land, and so a mobile phone call is not possible. That's why we didn't hear from any of the passengers. So he theorizes that the pilot who got out returns for brief periods with a portable oxygen bottle, finds the cockpit partly gutted. There's no possibility of communication. The pilot finally decides to turn northwest away from built-up areas to try to figure out how to handle this situation, turns the electrical AC bus back on, which repowers the satellite data unit. That explains that. But by then, the passengers and the rest of the crew have run out of oxygen. They're gone. The pilot sees that the situation is hopeless, sets the autopilot to a southerly heading, and then MH370 becomes a ghost flight. So that's the theory. It's an interesting theory. I don't know. What do you guys think? Is it crazy, plausible, too complicated? What do you think?
It's creepily well thought out.
It kind of is, isn't it?
It's so detailed. It's kind of, okay, what kind of person has the ability to think this kind of thing through? I don't know. Mr. Trescott, what are your thoughts?
Oh, I have a lot of mixed emotions about, you know, this whole thing. I mean, to me, it was such a huge tragedy to lose all these people. And, you know, I think your opening comment about there being a lot of, you know, kind of trash stories, clickbait stories out there, you know, kind of aligns with my initial reaction, you know, when I saw this story. I would agree that there are a lot of plausible things in the sequence. The one thing I find entirely implausible is that a surviving pilot would not descend the aircraft down to a level where people would have enough oxygen. You know, I just can't imagine, you know, why somebody would do that. So I think that someday, hopefully, we'll find out what really happened. In the meantime, there are going to be a lot of competing theories.
Yeah, for sure. You know, the poor families of the victims, your heart really goes out to them. I think they're still struggling with lack of closure in this situation. And I know that they're trying to keep this alive, trying to keep people from just forgetting about MH370. And there's some, you know, they meet regularly. They're, you know, trying to do what they can. But it's very difficult. Certainly a lot of money, a lot of time has been expended in the searches, because there's been several. I'm sure that someday we'll have a good accounting for what happened, but I don't know when that might be.
Am I the only one that found it amazing that it's been 5 years?
Yeah.
Oh, I had the same. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I wouldn't have guessed that.
No.
It's one of those things that I guess because we talked about it so much, I remember hearing about it, you know, and Air Malaysia is going to have another anniversary coming up very shortly, which is when they shot down the one over Ukraine, which was only a couple of weeks. That'll be the 5-year anniversary of that. I mean, it's hard to believe that time has flown by so quickly.
It really
is. That was two really, really bad events for the same airline around the same time.
Yeah, it. I think it really had a big impact on the airline and the viability of it. And I mean, that's just. I think that 1-2 punch is kind of unprecedented. I think.
Yeah, I agree.
All right, let's go back to a little bit of military news. In a rumor, this is from The Drive. Let's talk about the rumor that F-117s have flown missions in the Middle East recently. There have been some spottings of F-117 Nighthawks flying over Death Valley recently. And, David, the F-117 is supposed to be a retired airplane.
Well, sort of. Let's start off with they are in long-term storage and a portion of the aircraft are to be maintained in a flyable status. Now, last year, 2 years ago, where they were supposed to be scrapping 4 or demilitarizing 4 a year of the fleet. But last week, as we record this, it is March 4th, 2019. The week before, there was a lot of F-117s or one F-117 flying a lot over Death Valley. It's been a couple of years since we've had a sighting, but they weren't really hiding it. The F-117 is, and this article talks about Scramble in the Netherlands, and reporting that last couple of years that a possibility of four may have actually flown missions over Syria and Iraq. And one aircraft had a mechanical failure and had to return back to its base in the United Arab Emirates. Now, the F-117 is a unique aircraft with a very unique history, but it is a precision bomber. It is not a fighter, despite the F designation. And its primary weapon was laser-guided bombs, not precision-guided bombs. Now, our normal GPS-guided bombs have one inefficiency. While they're very precise, they don't do well with moving targets. Whereas a laser-guided bomb, you can pinpoint a moving target, keep your laser on the moving target, and the bomb will eventually hit the moving target. So it has that aspect. It also has, and this is one of the reasons why they were saying they were keeping them active, even though it is first or second generation stealth, it has an advantage that our current fifth generation fighters with stealth do not have, and that it was designed with low observable infrared. The ductbill exhaust, while it made the aircraft subsonic, it wasn't able to fly supersonic, had a very low profile for heat exhaust. So besides being a aircraft that was invisible or minimized to radar, it also had a very low infrared cross-section. Now, the Air Force has been using them to test their infrared search trackers, or IRST, and which is basically a new way to locate stealth aircraft, or an old way. We've had infrared search trackers for years, but the last couple of flights by F-117s have been seen. They usually are being chased by F-16s with IRST. So they're using that to sharpen the infrared tracking because the F-117's so observable. But you should definitely read Tyler Ridgway's article on the 117 and the reasons why it might have happened that they used these four aircraft in Syria and Iraq. Did it happen? I don't know, but it is nice to know that one of my all-time favorite aircraft that I've loved since it first showed up as a wobbly goblin in a grainy photograph in 1980s is still out there being a bit of a mystery. It's not often you get to see retired aircraft magically appear again and maybe having adventures that we just don't know about, but that's why we have Area 51 to keep our imaginations going.
Is it true that F-117 is inherently unstable, and it takes the computers to control to operate the control surfaces in a way that a human pilot could never do? Is that right?
That goes for any modern jet fighter.
Oh, really?
Well, most fly-by-wire aircraft are inherently unstable. The F-117, because of was originally when Lockheed originally came up with it, it was called the Hopeless Diamond. Because to make the aircraft invisible to radar, the facets on the aircraft reflect the radar, not besides the radar absorbing material or RAM on the outside of the aircraft, which is that black paint. It also bounces what other radar away from the receiver. So we talk about radar sends out a signal and then it bounces back to the receiver. Well, on an F-117, how the radar is it bounces it away from the receiver, making it a smaller radar cross-section. That's why when they were flying in civilian airspace, they put very large bricks on them, on the sides of them, so that it would stick out like a sore thumb so that the radars could find them. So, but because of that shape, it was a very unstable aircraft, and the aircraft was designed to be computer controlled. It's not super maneuverable like our modern aircraft, like the F-35 or the F-22, but it was maneuverable, and also the computers helped it be stable for the bombing. One of the things, Max, we could talk about is the original, one of the reasons why the XB-35, which was the original Northrop flying wing bomber, the Air Force didn't want, was because it evidently was inherently unstable to be a bomber because of the flying wing effect. The B-2 has computers that eliminated that problem. Even though the wing is the same size as the B-35, the computer technology had allowed the aircraft to compensate to provide stability. So as a general rule, most modern aircraft are unstable as far as military aircraft go and are computer assisted.
Interesting. Yeah, I thought it was just that one, the F-117. Interesting. All right.
Yeah, I thought it was just airplanes that I fly that are unstable when I'm behind them.
When you're flying them, huh?
When I'm behind the wheel. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, I bet that really has an impact on your students, huh?
Exactly.
Well, speaking of flying, this is from news24.com. Senior SAA pilot fired for flying with fake license for 20 years. A South African Airways pilot flew this whole time on a forged ATP license. That's not a good thing.
No, and I'm always amazed when we occasionally run across people who, you know, try and cheat the system. And, you know, they'll do it in various ways. You know, I one time saw somebody who was a student pilot who was flying solo but had a passenger along, you know, with him. I mean, that's a great example. I've actually recall a story with someone who went to jail for doing that and then subsequently lying about it. So, yeah, there's just this, you know, fraction of 1% of the population. And it's tiny. I mean, this kind of stuff is really, really rare in aviation, but it's, you know, consistent. So this particular story dates back more than 20 years ago. William Chandler joined South African Airways, and he had a commercial license. And part of the agreement was that within 5 years, he was to get his ATP, which is the air transport license, which is the highest one, and which is now required here in the U.S. For all pilots of airliners. It used to be you could fly without an ATP prior to some of the rules that came into effect after the Colgan air crash, when they decided that they were going to increase the requirements for airline pilots. But the way he got caught is kind of interesting. I found a second story here about it because I was curious, how, you know, what is this incident that occurred? The original story said that there was an incident involving a South African flight that occurred in Swiss airspace. And I found a separate article. It says that South African Airways Airbus A340, which was flight 260, departed November 5th from Johannesburg, South Africa, to Frankfurt, Germany, was en route at flight level 380, climbing to 390 over Switzerland when the aircraft encountered an overspeed. Now, they've got an error here. They say the speed over the ground increased to 530. Nobody would care if your ground speed increased, but this must have been some type of airspeed increase. They say the crew slowed the aircraft, continued to Frankfurt for a safe landing about 35 minutes later. German's BFU reported the aircraft encountered an overspeed event, rated the occurrence as a serious incident, and opened an investigation. And apparently, according to the Aviation Herald, the aircraft sustained multiple system faults in flight, including failures of the air data reference system numbers 2 and 3. So those would be the systems that give the display of airspeed, altitude, and vertical speed on the displays within the cockpit. And they said this was associated with the autopilot and the autothrust disengaging. And then they apparently that particular aircraft was grounded for 3 days and then flew back to Johannesburg as South African Airways flight 4263. Well, in March of this year, South African Airways opened, the CAA, so the regulatory agency in South Africa, opened an investigation into the pilot on that incident. Turned out he'd been flying with a forged license for more than 20 years. So apparently, rather than get his ATP, he faked those credentials. And interestingly, back in 1994, he was expected to be promoted to captain, and he turned down that promotion because he would have had to resubmit all his documents at that point in time.
Oh, he couldn't. Yeah, He wouldn't pass that.
Exactly. And I've got my dates wrong. He joined as a pilot in 1994, should have had his ATP by 1995, and in 2005 was ready for the upgrade but turned it down. So all because of this overspeed incident, this guy has been fired, and there are reports that they may try and recover more than $1 million that they've paid him fraudulently over the past 20 years.
Which I'm sure isn't sitting in his bank account right now, just waiting for the airline to take it back.
Exactly.
So that's very interesting. So if it weren't for this overspeed condition and the investigation that resulted, he'd be flying still today, probably.
And I think that's how a lot of stuff gets caught. And when incidents occur, that's when the FAA or whichever regulatory agency is involved just starts peeling back the onion, looks at all the documentation, and that's where these things typically pop up. I think pilots often can fly for years and not be caught with flying without licenses and so on. But it's that one time when they have some kind of incident where they end up getting caught.
Hmm. Now, in no way would I justify what this individual did, but from a safety standpoint, do you think it really makes that much difference? I mean, after 20 years, do you think there's likely to be any significant difference in his ability to fly an aircraft safely?
No, probably not. But you kind of got to ask the question, why didn't he go to the effort to get that particular license? Would have been a little more study, another check ride, some expense involved. But I would imagine that he would have passed that. So it's pretty short sight of him to have skipped over that required license.
Sure. Hey, we have a video of the week. We do that from time to time on the UAV Digest, very rarely on this show. I suspect this video of the week came from you, David.
It did. It's just cool.
It is.
Not everybody gets to see the United States demonstration teams. However, this is a little longer than normal, but it's close to a 15-minute video of a practice of the F-35 demonstration that is just this year is coming to. And it's a phenomenal video. There's now, mind you, there's some trees involved and some other things, but what the F-35 gets put through, if you don't think it's a fifth-generation capable aircraft, this video will change your mind. And I know enough about these demos that if it's capable of doing this, you can't imagine what else it's capable of doing, because they never show their whole hand. So I recommend watching it. It's quite enjoyable and pretty good video footage for someone sitting out just watching the practice off of Hill Air Force Base.
Yeah, this was put up by airshowstuff.com. But like you say, David, it just seems like it's somebody with a decent enough camera, but nothing terribly fancy, kind of on the other side of the fence, and photographing or videoing this performance or this practice session. And like you say, sometimes it's shot through trees. Sometimes when the jet is farther away, you can hear birds or traffic on the road. So from a perfect production standpoint, it's a little lacking. But in terms of just watching this F-35 perform and listening to the sound of the engine, I just really got off on that.
I wonder why. Could it be that it's a Pratt Whitney engine? No.
There's nothing like a fighter engine, though. Great sounds. So we'll put a player right in the show notes. So just go to airplanegeeks.com/542, and you'll find the show notes there. And you'll be able to watch the video right there in the show notes. Definitely worth watching. If you're hardcore, you're going to watch the whole 14 minutes, 15 minutes. But otherwise, just catch it. And it's pretty impressive performance. I'm hoping, is that demonstration team, David, going to be at any air shows that you or I are likely to attend this year?
I know. Yeah, I'll make sure that the list is in the show notes. But yeah, I'm sure that we're going to see it. I know that I'm going to see it at least once. And I think Ocean City or Atlantic City was one of the ones where I was going to see it.
Ah, okay, good.
It and the Red Arrows are my two big things for air shows this year.
All right. Something else that we haven't had in a while is an airplane of the week. And David, you bring us one this time.
I do, and I sort of bring it from Hawaii, if that makes any sense. So this is going to be... It's a little more than an airplane of the week, but it's got a little bit of everything in it for everybody. So here we go. I realize I've seen many rare aircraft, but last month I saw a really rare one. So rare it's not even complete. What also made it special was it was in a place where it had its biggest impact. The Pacific Aviation Museum has some amazing aircraft. They represent aircraft from the 30s to the modern day. I was there to see one aircraft, the Nakajima B-5N, the Imperial Japanese Navy's torpedo bomber. First flown in January 1937, the Type K was a three-seat torpedo bomber. Flown against the Mitsubishi B-5M, it was awarded a contract by the IGN and became officially the Type 97 carrier attack bomber. The B-5N-1 was a three-place aircraft. It was typical of all torpedo bombers of the day, the Douglas TBD Devastator and the Fairey Swordfish, all had pretty much the same layout. The pilot, bombardier navigator, and radio operator observer, gunner. Since the B-5N-1 was underpowered originally, one position was replaced for weight savings. That also was done with the Fairey Swordfish. The B-5N was powered by a Nakajima Sake 11 radial engine. The 14-cylinder twin-row radial generated 1,000 horsepower. The Model 11 also powered the A6M20s. During the Sino-Japanese War, the B-5N1s were determined to be under-armored for the crew and fuel tanks. However, this was done to ensure performance. It would also be a persistent issue for most Japanese aircraft in World War II until late in the war. The B-5N was a large carrier aircraft. It was 33 feet 9.5 inches long with a wingspan of 50 feet 11 inches. The airframe was designed to carry an 800-kilogram bomb or the Type 91 torpedo. The Type 91 torpedo was one of the most advanced torpedoes of the day. It either had a 470-pound or 1,160-pound explosive warhead. It had a range of up to 2,000 meters at 42 knots. What made the almost 18-foot torpedo so deadly was the wooden fins, which made it more aerodynamic, so it could be dropped by the B-5N at almost 50 feet above the water at maximum speed. The wooden fins would break off during the impact of water. The other advancement was the use of a control system that would allow the torpedo to run in shallow harbors. This was important for a harbor in the Hawaiian chain of islands. With some of the lessons learned from the war over China, this was to be an integral aircraft until the B-6N Tenzin. It was the B-5N-2 that carried Commander Mitsuyoshi Fushida, leading the first wave in AI-301. It was he who crossed the north shore of Oahu at 7:40 a.m. and ordered Tenkai, or attack position. 9 minutes later, his radio man sent the signal to To-To-To, which caused confusion for the wave of dive bombers and Zeros. The B-5N-2 with torpedoes and the Val dive bombers attacked simultaneously. AI-301 was one of the horizontal bombers. At 8:06 a.m., a B-5N-2 from the carrier Hiro dropped a bomb which landed on the front turret 2 of the USS Arizona. The armor-piercing bomb detonated the ammunition magazine, blowing the interior of the Pennsylvania-class battleship. Besides being fully armed, the Arizona was to depart for the continental United States the next morning, so was fully fueled and had all crew aboard. Fushida would also send the most infamous message of all, Tora, 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 the code meaning the attack was successful and that the battleships were sunk. Fushida and his crew would continue to circle and provide observations and was the last aircraft to return to the Japanese fleet after the attack. Five BN-2s were shot down on December 7, 1941. B-5N2s were also credited with sinking the USS Hornet and Lexington and the disabling of the Yorktown. By then, the B-5N2 was known by another name, Kate. The Japanese designation system was very complicated. Each aircraft had two designations. One was a manufacturer designation, like the A-6M fighter, A being fighter, 6 being Mitsubishi. And it was also known as the Navy Type 0 carrier fighter, the 0 being the imperial year of 2600. Thus, the premier fighter for Japan was the 0. By the middle of 1942, Captain Frank T. McCoy, attached to the Allied Technical Air Intelligence Unit in Australia, came up with a designation system. Originally, the system was fighters and everything else. Fighters were named for boys and girls' names for everything else. Thus, the A-6M was given the name Zeke, and the B-5N2 was given the name Kate. Eventually, the system became more complicated. Zeke and Roof were examples of hillbilly names that McCoy grew up with and tried to use as humorous. McCoy didn't have much luck with the A-6M aircraft being Zeke, since it never stuck because zero it was. The clipped wing A-6M-3, originally called HAP, was called that until General Arnold didn't approve of the namesake, and it quickly became the HAMP. On October 14, 1945, a group of New Zealand F-4U Corsairs escorted a B-5N2 Kate to surrender. The Kate languished in Jacinto Bay until it was moved and broke apart for souvenirs. Eventually, the Kate through New Guinea, New Zealand, and Australia eventually landed at Ford Island at the Pacific Aviation Museum in Pearl Harbor, where she was put on display on April of 2016. She's far from complete, but does represent a significant aircraft. So with that, this is David M. Vanderhoof, your Airplane Geeks historian, signing off.
Wow. How did you find the museum, David?
How did I find it? Well, I took a bus Pearl Harbor. No.
Sorry.
It's a really neat museum. Being that it is on Ford Island, one of their things is their hangars still have bullet holes from the attack. They have two hangars. The first hangar is dedicated more towards the battle. It has a Japanese Zero, the Kate, as well as a Hellcat. It has a Wildcat and a P-40. If you're an airliner buff, it has a really cool display about Pan Am and the Hawaiian Islands. So it's not just military aircraft. And then in the second hangar, it has an eclectic group of aircraft. A lot of them have significance because they were flown in Hawaii. Our friend John, who flies the Shark, his helicopter is one of the aircraft, his H-60. They have quite a few Air National Guard aircraft that actually flew in Hawaii. Their F-102 Delta Daggers in Hawaii markings. They have an F-86 in Hawaiian markings. They do have an F-14D. They have a Hawaii F-15. They also have some foreign aircraft. They have an F-5A from South Korea, which is kind of cool. And our guys from Down Under sent a pig up to there, and they have an F-111F in Australian markings that was given there. So besides the World War II and the control tower, et cetera, and the attack and the significance of Pearl Harbor, they do have a very unique collection, and it is more about the modern aircraft is about aviation in the Pacific, and they're continue to grow that. I highly recommend it. It was a good day. I spent the morning at the Arizona Memorial and took the tour and saw the Missouri. I did not take the tour of the Missouri, to be honest, because there's the New Jersey 35 minutes away, and I've been aboard a Iowa-class battleship. But I was happy, and I wanted to see the Kate, even though, and I'll, we'll use and the zero indicate will be in the show notes. But there's only two of them. The other one is in England, and there really is not a lot of aircraft there. So, but it is a historically significant aircraft, and considering it was the aircraft that sank the Arizona, it is appropriate for it to be there, and it adds more meaning than if you had seen it at, say, like the Air Force Museum or something. It adds a lot more context to it. So I'm glad I went. It was really my day at Pearl Harbor was a really good day.
Fantastic. All right. Thanks, David. All right. What's up with the geeks? Some events coming up. One real quickly on Saturday, March 9th, 2019, at the New England Air Museum is Women Take Flight. The event is from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. They've got a bunch of activities planned. Some speakers, women who are accomplished in different ways in different fields in aviation. A lot of groups that will be represented there, companies, Collins Aerospace, Command, Pratt & Whitney, Sikorsky, as well as things like the Women in Aviation Connecticut chapter, the Wright Sister Engineering Club, the Bombardier Hartford Service Center. Looks like it's going to be a great day. So you might want to check that out if you're in the area. And then I think my next event after that, aviation-wise anyway, is Sun and Fun. That, of course, is April 2nd through 7th in Lakeland, Florida. Max T is going. Rob Mark will be there. Launchpad Merzari will be there. A bunch of folks will be there. So hopefully we'll get everybody connected one way or another for that. Max, you got all your reservations made?
Oh, please ask me any other question. I'm always slow about that. So, nope. But I was there last, I think, in 2012. So I'll see if I can snag the same hotel that I had before, assuming it's still there. Yes, I have in the past flown into Tampa because it's probably just a slightly shorter drive than flying into Orlando. And it's a slightly shorter flight and so on. But I'll have to do the usual comparing of tickets and stuff like that. But yeah, I will be giving a whole lot of presentations there. I'll mention this in a future episode here on our show as to what presentations I'm giving on what days. But I think I'm presenting just about every day, Tuesday through Saturday on various topics. So it should be a fun show. And I've got a local presentation coming up here. So anybody in the San Francisco Bay Area, I give a Bay Tour seminar, which tells folks how to navigate the complex airspace here around San Francisco. And this time I'll be giving that presentation down at San Martin Airport. And that's going to be on March the 12th, which I guess is a Tuesday night. And that'll be around 7 o'clock. They serve dinner at about 6. That's going to be at the Wings of History Museum, right behind the San Martin Airport. That's probably, 20, 30 minutes south of San Jose, California.
Ah, excellent. All right. Shout out. We heard from Patrick, our listener Patrick, who sent us a link. U.S. female fighter pilots, March 8 recruitment campaign, upcoming movie. This is a kind of a trailer for that. And I clicked on this to see what this was all about. I saw this trailer. I was at the movies the other day, and they were doing a preview, and they showed this video. David, this is pretty exciting.
It is, especially if you like Captain Marvel, which I'm looking forward to. And as we're recording this tonight, this is a first. I've never heard this happening before, but Captain Marvel is opening in Hollywood today. And in honor of Captain Marvel, to show you how much the Air Force has bought into this movie, is going to be a flyover by the United States Air Force Thunderbirds.
Wow.
For the movie opening. But one of the things they are leveraging with Captain Marvel, who, if you're not familiar with Captain Marvel, is she is a United States Air Force fighter pilot. And the Air Force wants to encourage women in the Air Force. And so that's where this trailer is being leveraged. So you'll have Carol Danvers, Captain Carol Danvers, who is an F-15 pilot in the movie. And this is a way of bringing other women and showing the current women in the United States Air Force, which is a big deal, considering we even have our number 6 ship Thunderbird being piloted by a woman this year. So the Air Force is all in for women in aviation.
I like how they approach this, too. It says every superhero has an origin story. And the idea here is that you can have your own origin story in the U.S. Air Force. It's pretty effective. But we'll have it right in the show notes. You'll be able to watch this video in the show notes. So I encourage you to take a look. This is a short one. It's very short. I think it's under a minute, if I remember correctly. But it's worth watching. And a lot of good jets in the picture. A little bit of listener mail. We were talking, was it last week? We were talking about famous siblings, aviation siblings.
Yes, we were. It was last week. I know it seems like 5 years ago.
I know. It does. It really does. It really does. So John wrote in and pointed out one that we should have thought of. This is the Stinson sisters and their brother. But Catherine and Marjorie Stinson, a pair of aviators from early last century, quite accomplished and with some great history. So thanks, John, for reminding us of the Stinsons.
Well, let's talk about them very briefly. When I saw that, I thought, whoa, did they start, Stinson Aircraft Company? And the answer is no, they didn't. They happen to have the same last name. But one of them was the fourth female to get a pilot's license here in the United States. Her younger sister later got a pilot's license as well. One of them was the first to do a loop, the first woman to do a loop in an aircraft. They tried to do a U.S. mail route. I'm not sure that was successful. Ultimately, the family ended up starting an aviation school in Texas, and the two sisters were involved in that school. And then went on to do a number of different things. One ultimately became a draftsman with the aeronautical division of the U.S. Navy. So two very accomplished sisters in the early days of aviation.
Yeah, great. That's very cool.
And with that, Max Trescott is now officially the historian, so I don't have to do any work anymore.
No. I just know how to read, that's all.
And that was from John, and we heard from Jonathan just today, actually. I'm not sure you guys have had a chance to even see this one, but I liked it. And so just wanted to mention, he writes in, says, in episode 539, when discussing the development of the 747, the topic of in-airplane piano bars was discussed. Although the idea did not catch on with the 747, the A380 does have a rather sizable lounge on the upper deck, but no piano. And Emirates A380s have a shower, which I've been fortunate to experience a few times.
Is that like showering back in high school in gym class? I'm just wondering, is that?
You mean with a group of strangers?
That's right. I mean, how many people shower at a time on an A380? That's what I want to know.
I bet it's big enough for just one. But I think it's a great idea. Anyway, Jonathan goes on. Here's a picture. He sends a picture of him behind the bar on the Emirates 380, and we'll put that in the show notes. This looks pretty cool. He says, FYI, the bottle of scotch I was working on was hidden to protect the innocent. That's funny. Jonathan's a former C-5 Galaxy instructor pilot, and he says, I can relate to flaring and landing a large airplane from several stories high. Even after extensive simulator time during initial training, my first landing in the C-5 surely put a dent in the runway at Altus Air Force Base, Oklahoma. Fortunately, the second one was much better. Keep up the good work. That's from Jonathan.
Let me see if I understand that. The second dent was better? Is that what he's saying?
The second landing.
The second landing.
Yeah,
okay.
Less of a dent in the runway.
Yeah, and I would imagine a C-5 actually could put a dent in the runway. That's a lot of weight.
Yeah,
of course, it's spread out over a lot of different wheels, so I'm sure I didn't. But what a humorous way to describe a rough landing.
Yes, yeah, yeah. So when you're up there in a C-5 or the A380, all those stories above the runway. There's no landing gear camera or something like that, is there, to help
you? Well, let's see. Didn't the Concorde have something like that? And I know that some of the newer aircraft will actually call out the height above the runway, which has got to be incredibly helpful. I mean, I think for folks who were flying 747s and, you know, planes like that where they didn't have any kind of guidance like that, yeah, you really had to get your sight picture correct. But David, who has cameras? Do you know?
I think it's like the A380 has a camera, but I still think you use your instruments. I mean, when in 1969, there weren't cameras on 747s, you know, and one of the biggest concerns was by Boeing, they weren't really worried about the takeoff and landings. What they really were worried about was the taxiing and, you know, and what happened with the, unfortunately, the Boeing was concerned of what happens in airplane. You know, when the 747 goes crashing through the terminal. So, I mean, I think it's was basically old age steam gauges, and you counted your feet down until you felt the wheels touch.
Now, there might have been a radar altimeter in some of those aircraft, but unfortunately, the altimeter is just not going to be set accurately enough to use that to go, okay, I'm right now at, you know, 45 feet. You know, that's easily off 10, 20 feet, even if the setting is correct. So I think a lot of that was just eyeball. I always, whenever I take off in a different aircraft, I usually take a moment before the takeoff and just kind of look out the window and see, all right, what does this view look like before I start rolling down the runway? And then try to remember, okay, I need to be somewhere around this height just as I'm touching down when I come back around.
That sounds very wise. Yeah, because, I mean, you're more excited about or focused on other things. And when you're coming in for the landing, it's if you haven't thought about it explicitly, it's kind of hard to remember, you know, where your relative height is.
Exactly right. And different aircraft are different heights above the runway. I just read a couple of weeks ago about Sonics, the single-engine experimental home-built jet. And they apparently, of course, that's a single-seater. So that makes learning to fly a little bit difficult. But they have set up a glider, which is about the same height off the runway because both are extremely low. And they've put a jet engine on the back of the glider. And so they're able to give dual instruction because there are two seats in the glider, and that way people can figure out, you know, what does the sight picture look like ahead of time before they strap into the Sonics for their first flight by themselves.
Right.
And then of course you have the infamous U2 landing, which requires a high performance sports car to chase it down the runway, and as it's landing, the whatever Corvette, Mustang, whatever the Air Force is currently using, is bolting down the runway, and one guy's driving and the other pilot is sitting there talking the person down. You've got 10 feet, you've got 8 feet, you've got, because there's little to no visibility in a U-2, and a U-2 is just a giant glider with an engine, so it doesn't really want to land anyway. So that's the other, there's another way that you can get talked into the ground.
Well, and I do know what one of those chase cars is right now. I saw a story about a year and a half ago in Popular Mechanics magazine. I was able to just pull it up real quickly, and they spotted a Tesla Model S sedan being used at RAF Fairford at the U.S. Air Force Base there in the United Kingdom, and apparently it was running down the runway as part of a landing with a U-2.
Ha. Well, an electric car, I mean, that kind of makes sense because...
It does.
Yeah, because of all that torque and the ability to accelerate really quickly. Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, that's an interesting aspect about electric motors, that apparently you can get, what, the full torque even at low RPM. And so that's why you get, you know, 0 to 60 records out of a Tesla versus out of a Corvette.
Right, exactly. All right, well, we want to thank all of you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. You can find us on our website, airplanegeeks.com. As we mentioned earlier, if you want to take a look at the show notes, you can go straight there, airplanegeeks.com/542. be sure to check out the two videos that you'll find there, at least, as well as links to all the stories and items that we talk about. You can find us in all the usual places. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, your favorite podcast app. We're also on Stitcher, Spotify, Pandora, and probably a few others that I can't think of right now. But let's tell folks where they can find each of us online. And David Vanderhoof, we'll start with you.
You can find me online on Twitter at DM Vanderhoof. You can find me on our Slack listener team. You can do that. You can join that club by sending us an email to thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. And of course, you can find me on Friday mornings with that guy, Max Flight, talking about drones and flying taxis on the UAVdigest.com.
You know, that's the one thing that I wished I'd asked Bert and Dick Rutan a couple of weekends ago when I saw them, is what they thought about all this urban air mobility stuff, and if they thought that this was something that really is going to take hold and represent the future, or if it's just kind of wishful dreaming. I would have been interested to hear what they thought about that. But
I think that's a great question. I look back at things like the Eclipse jet, which was supposed to darken the sky with dentists. There were going to be yes, thousands of these things all over the country. And, well, gosh, they built 285 of them, and poof, that was the end of it. So some of these projections about how things are going to radically change often, you know, don't come to fruition. So I think this is an interesting one to watch.
Yeah, very much so. And particularly because, and Dave and I talk about this on the UAV Digest all the time, but particularly because not only are there many small startups and, you know, entrepreneurs and, you know, VC money working on these concepts, but also we have some big companies involved as well, you know, Boeing and Airbus particularly, maybe, you know, usually the flash in the pan kinds of visionaries don't come out of big companies like that, big conservative companies like that. But we are seeing them getting involved here. So I don't know. Maybe I don't know if that means, you know, there's more credence to the vision or not. But I can't wait to see. All right. So I've sidetracked this. Max Trescott, where do folks find you online?
Oh, at the usual places, Twitter, Facebook, and especially at aviationnewstalk.com. Click on contact at the top and you can send me an email, and definitely check out the podcast wherever you find your podcast.
Good. And of course, you can find me, Max Flight, on LinkedIn, as David said, at the UAVdigest.com. Also with Mary Kirby at paxexpodcast.com. That's PAXEX. Podcast.com, all one word. And if you want to send me an email, if you want to chat about, you know, these other two guys here or anything you'd like, it's maxflight@airplanegeeks.com. Our outro, you know, I think I'm going to put Bruno on hold this episode, and maybe our outro will be a little bit of glorious sounds from an F-35. So I won't play the entire 14 minutes of the video we talked about, but I think I'll give you a little taste of that. So you may be listening to that now. So with that, I'll say please join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
Keep the blue side up.
And thanks for listening.